From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This past Sunday saw May Day celebrations across the globe, with workers marching across Europe expressing anger over labor conditions and austerity. In Turkey, the demonstrations turned deadly, with at least one protester killed by a water cannon deployed by police, who also used tear gas and other means to try to break up the rallies. Anger among workers was evident in Berlin's May Day rallies, as CCTV's Guy Henderson reports.
We have seen large protest marches which traditionally take place here May Day, the International Labour Day, organised by workers' unions and workers' parties. Occasionally, as the sun sets and night falls here, there has been a tendency for some of those protests to turn violent. Given, firstly, a violent protest outside the venue for a right-wing party's annual conference in the city of Stuttgart this weekend, and also, I think, given the general political climate, given the divisions which have resulted from an ongoing refugee crisis and debates around how Germany should deal with that refugee crisis, there is, I think, an increased fear that this year, 2016, could be a year in which there is a heightened risk of those protests leading to violence. We have seen a few small isolated incidences so far, but by the same token, the police over the years, and particularly in recent years, have got quite used to dealing with these protests and channeling them and keeping them on the whole fairly peaceful. Guy Henderson, CCTV. Berlin.
In Moscow, there was a massive presence celebrating the annual Workers' Day, which this year was also the date of Orthodox Easter. RT's Murad Gazdiev was there and filed this report.
You'll see marches like this one happening all over the world. The difference is you won't find anyone throwing Molotov cocktails or burning tires here. A couple of fellows behind us have been all for another communist revolution. But this day, for 70 years under the Soviet Union, was about celebration. It isn't about protesting. It's about celebrating what workers have achieved, the rights they've secured themselves, and it's about supporting those into the future.
Paris, the ongoing worker protests were heightened as opposition continues to build against the new laws proposed by socialist President François Hollande that unions in particular and workers in general oppose overwhelmingly. Press TV's Rahman Mazahari was in Paris Sunday and filed this report.
The long-running fight against proposed labor code changes in France has reached its stretch run. More than 100,000 people marched across the country to demand that President François Hollande withdraw his right-wing plan that will gut the powers of unions, allow mass layoffs without warning, increase tolerance for labor law abuses, and much more. Many millions of people have taken to the streets recently as there have been near-daily protests and strikes for almost 2 months. The nightly nationwide sit-ins, known as the Nuit Debout protests, threaten to upend the political mainstream by establishing a new, truly leftist party.
The government was elected on certain promises, and yet they installed a new liberal program which has justifiably aroused the anger of the people. But with the up-all-night protests, it's clear that we are trying to truly create a new France which is based on principles and defend people and not money.
After more than 4.5 years of austerity measures, France is resisting more than ever, but it may not be enough to sway the government.
The National Assembly will begin debating the proposals on Tuesday, and so far, all indications are that the socialist-dominated parliament will approve the deeply unpopular measures.
Many believe the only way to protect the will of the majority is to shut down the country with a general strike. Calls for just such a move were heard up and down the demonstration.
We can stop this law by staying in the streets, because the withdrawal of this proposal is the only viable solution. This fight against the labor cut is the truly battle for the soul of France. If the unions represent the average person like they should, they will call for a general strike nationwide.
Once again, police used violence against protesters, as hundreds have been arrested in recent weeks and a countless number subjected to tear gas. Parliamentary vote will take place in a week shortened by a public holiday, but which will likely see even more tension. Ramin Mazahiri, Press TV, Paris.
Here in the U.S., a peaceful May Day march in Seattle turned violent when police tried to disperse protesters, who in turn refused to follow orders to disperse and hurled rocks and bricks at security personnel. Five officers were reportedly injured and at least nine demonstrators reportedly arrested. Demonstrators held May Day rallies across the U.S., demanding higher wages for workers and an end to deportations. Well, after a week of TV talking heads and newspaper and radio commentators saying that the presidential primaries are all but over except for the final song, Democratic hopeful Bernie Sanders was out on the road doubling down on his efforts, pointing out that both the delegate count and polling data indicate that he can and should be the party's nominee after the dust settles at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia in July. This Tuesday, we'll see an open primary contest in Indiana. For a look forward through the campaign, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero via telephone Monday. Sanders doesn't seem to be acquiescing and going into that good night just quite yet.
Mm-mm. No, not at all. And there are good reasons for him not to, including the fact that there are some readings of how this thing could go that suggests that in July, the Democratic Party at its convention could have a deadlocked convention. In other words, where neither of them has the requisite number to get the nomination on the first vote. So California is huge. Indiana is important, but it's not a game changer. They could come out of Indiana almost even in the delegates. Hillary will probably win the majority of the popular vote, but they'll be close in terms of delegate count coming out of Indiana. And what the Clinton campaign wants is just to control the narrative, but they're having great problems controlling the narrative because the people who count, that is, the Bernie Sanders voters and activists, are not listening to the Clinton narrative. So I think Bernie has every reason to go forward.
And, you know, one of the things that I found interesting about the attempt to just sort of sideswipe, I should say attempts, really, to sideswipe Sanders, that, you know, Clinton invoking 2008 saying, look, you know, I got out of the way and I got right behind Obama and I didn't, you know, press him for anything, although she did end up Secretary of State like 5 minutes after he took office. You know, you have all these various voices talking about party unity and, you know, holding out the specter of Trump and all of that as a reason for them to shut up and get behind Clinton. Mm-hmm. But Clinton actually, even if she carries the bulk of the rest of the contests, you know, if she does, say, 60-40 on the rest of the contests, without the superdelegates, she won't have enough pledged delegates either. And so it seems that either the superdelegates are going to decide there won't be a brokered convention or they will.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, this is the whole problem that the Clinton forces face. It is a kind of a win-lose situation. They could win the nomination and lose the base of the party. By the base, I mean not just black voters and labor voters and you know, those professional, technical, managerial types, but they could lose that activist youth, a force that has propelled Bernie. And in a serious showdown with Donald Trump in the general election, they're going to need all of Hillary's people. Now, the Trump forces have already made overtures to both Bernie Sanders and to his people. And they're saying that you have more in common with us than you have with Hillary Clinton. That's why the questions of war and peace and international questions become so important in this election. And if it is fought out, the general election, assuming that it's a Trump and Clinton race, if it is fought out over international relations, she loses. On the other hand, if it's a Trump-Sanders race, I think Sanders goes into the whole thing with an advantage over Trump. But the opposite is the case with Clinton.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that given the just the federal budget, aside from the, you know, the various other issues involved, looking at the shortage of funds on the federal books for all of the things that are absolutely necessary to working people here, the health care, education, relief in their mortgage. I mean, there's still 10, 20 million people who are technically in a state of foreclosure. They're just hanging in their houses that are sooner or later going to be ushered out. There's no money for any of that, and trillions for things like new nuclear weapons. You would think that foreign policy would be a very important part of the campaign.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you see, and one of the things, if Clinton is the Democratic nominee, that she is going to have to carry into this election is the fact that the Obama administration has cut the federal budget more than any administration in modern history. They have cut trillions out of the federal budget. And most of this has to do with social programs, infrastructure rebuilding, schools, healthcare, and the like. And the only way that the Hillary Clinton program of war and nation building and regime change can be realized is if there are further, deeper cuts in the federal budget. So I think Hillary Clinton, no matter what way we look at it, carries such tremendous deficits into the general election that the Democratic Party would be wise, and I'm not going to say they are a wise party, but they would be wise to go with Bernie Sanders. That's their best shot at winning the White House.
And you know, so you pointed me to these two pieces over the weekend in the New York Times, one by Charles Blow and the other by Maureen Dowd. Charles Blow saying basically any talk by people on Trump's side of a commonality with Sanders supporters just goes to prove that, you know, Sanders is no better for black folks than any other white politician, and that the Clintons, of course, have been very good for black folks. Mm-hmm. But the Clinton administration and the Obama administration, for that matter, who Blow also says has done marvels for folks here in the United States, have been the architects of this massive transfer of wealth and income away from black and other communities that needed it.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Charles Blow, I think, as I read that op-ed this morning, I think Blow is manifesting the panic state that the Hillary Clinton forces and the 1% face and are in at this time. Let me give you an example. Once the primaries got out of the South, Bernie Sanders, although he is not well known in the black community, began to get a minimum of 30% of the black vote in states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Missouri. And then in Pennsylvania, he got over 35% of the black vote, which meant that he probably got close to 40% in the city of Philadelphia. This is without a very strong campaign and with a closed primary and with a situation where there was a lot of voter suppression. And in other words, independents couldn't vote in the primary, and there was a real kind of effort to keep the vote down. In spite of that, somehow Sanders got over 36% in the state of Pennsylvania, maybe close to 40% in Philadelphia. I think going forward, that looks good for any opponent to Hillary Clinton. There is no guarantee that with all of that talk about how good the Clintons have been to black folk, and we know the record, but with all of that talk and with all of her pandering and carrying a hot sauce in her pocketbook and all of that nonsense, black voters, especially young black voters, are very unhappy with Clinton and are looking for an alternative.
And you also have the whole body of the Democratic Party establishment, including the bulk of black elected public officials that are in Clinton's camp.
Yeah. Well, that begins to indicate, I think, these numbers of black voters that are going to Bernie Sanders. It begins to indicate that there is dissatisfaction in the black community with a good part of the black elected officials, including the black congressional caucus. I just think, we're in a period of political turmoil, two insurgent movements. Everybody recognizes it now, from people like Maureen Dow and Charles Blow in the New York Times and Edward Luce today in the Financial Times, that none of the verities, none of the assumed truths of the past, even of the past 8 years or 4 years ago, will apply in this election. Because now you're dealing with dissatisfaction at a level that we have not seen in decades in this country. And people are voting their dissatisfaction. Now, Charles Blow, cites these survey figures that show that of all of the population groups in the United States, black people rank highest in saying that things are better now than they were 50 years ago. Well, that's a relative statement. 50 years ago, most black people didn't have the right to vote and did not have the protection of the federal constitution. In other words, we were at best second-class citizens. We're not much beyond that now. But that's pretty much what I think black people are saying when they say things are better. They're not saying things are good, because when you look at mass incarceration, police brutality, the collapse of public education, poverty, and all of these things, black people are in a very precarious state. And there's some subtleties in the way black people are thinking that are not captured in most of these surveys.
And some of the things aren't so subtle. For example, there has been a greater loss of wealth in the black community over the past 8 years than in history.
Absolutely. And that has to do with so many of us losing our homes, which is our major wealth. We have been set back in ways that it has still not yet been fully calculated by social science or economists or scholars and researchers. Because so much of black suffering has been made invisible and unheard during the Obama administration. And frankly, that was part of its purpose, to silence and make invisible and to be a distraction from black suffering and the needs of the black masses of people. In a lot of ways, the program of Bernie Sanders is more pro-black than the program of Barack Obama. And at some point, someone is going to stand up and say it and argue it. And at some point, growing numbers of black folk are going to arrive at the conclusion that the first black president had carried out a program that advanced anti-black racism and anti-black poverty. And I think that's a truth, and it's really an inconvenient truth for so many black people for obvious reasons, and reasons we can understand. Hundreds of years of being kept in the back, and now you have a black president, but the truth is that the black president did not serve the interests of black people.
Looking at Indiana and forward from there, Indiana is one of the open primary states. Now, Sanders has been pointing out that his numbers in a run-up against Trump, look at the entire electorate, and he has much stronger positioning among independents than Hillary Clinton. Are we going to see some of that manifest in the primary in Indiana, do you think?
Well, I hope so. If it's an open primary, Bernie has an advantage. She does not do that well in open primaries. And of course, Indiana is one of those states that has been devastated by deindustrialization and these foreign trade agreements, et cetera. So it would seem that there's a lot there that's positive for Sanders.
Because Indianapolis in particular, if you look at number one, majority black population, one of the strongest black communities in the country historically, one of the most devastated by the deindustrialization of the United States, particularly the auto industry and steel and such, and much of that done on the watch of the Clinton administration, a great deal of it. And I'm wondering if lining up a bunch of black political officials and Democratic Party apparatus, get out the vote effort, et cetera, really are going to be able to lift Clinton the way the polls indicate. At least she's running neck and neck at the moment.
Well, let's be real. The Democratic Party fears the Democratic voters. They cannot rely upon them. And you take New York and Pennsylvania, and I'm kind of proud to say that we cut her margin of victory a bit here in Pennsylvania. I think she won by 14 points or 12 points here. And that was a little bit better than New York. Of course, Wall Street went all out there to protect their home turf, as it were. Right. But they're afraid of the voters. They're afraid of the Democratic voters, but they're afraid of the independent voters, because most people who register independent are dissatisfied with the two parties, period. And a big part of them are dissatisfied with the economic system of neoliberal capitalism. So they're prey to these people. I think Sanders, and especially his brilliant wife, Jane, and his very courageous wife, by the way, I think they understand this thing very, very well. I think they have the correct analysis going forward. Indiana is important, but the real battleground before the July convention is California. And it is a microcosm in many ways of the United States. Now, the Clinton people are saying they can rely upon minority voters, and I'm not so certain of that.
Looking at the class based activity around this election, particularly the obvious and well-expressed dissatisfaction of the working class with their political institutions generally, manifest both in Sanders' campaigns and Trump's, for that matter. What kind of levers can people bring to bear to both advance the cause of unity among the working class, and also to interject the power that could come from that unity into this election?
Well, I think, that is the thinking that we have to engage in going forward. And I think there's some people who are already beginning to think about these things. These questions were being raised early on in the American Federation of Teachers, when the leadership came out early endorsing Clinton, and caucuses throughout the country, including the leadership of the Chicago Teachers Union, sided with Bernie. And then locals in the Teamsters, locals in the communication workers, the Transport Workers Union, and other unions have openly endorsed Bernie Sanders. But I think the whole question of what class unity will look like going forward is huge. We already see the incipient form of a new class unity and a new rank and file struggle against the misleaders of the trade union movement. This is already happening. I think we might see this whole thing exploding. Now, something we have not yet discussed is what happens if Bernie Sanders doesn't endorse Clinton at the Democratic Party convention. And he's been making noises like he might not. And certainly his wife, Jane, has set the bar very high for an endorsement of Clinton. I mean, Clinton doesn't respect Sanders. She doesn't respect the movement. She doesn't, and she really doesn't respect Jane Sanders. So she's not the type, I think, that would want to compromise or come to some agreement on principle with people like the Sanders movement. So it might not be an endorsement. And then we're in a whole new ball game.
Right. And, you know, looking at that, let's say coming through Philadelphia, you know, the possibilities are Sanders wins or he doesn't. And if he doesn't, and by win, I just mean gets anointed or doesn't. If he doesn't, then either there's an embracing by Sanders of Clinton and the call for party unity, or there's not. Go back to 1984 when Jesse Jackson ran and had a sizable constituency inside the Democratic Party that was assembled, a new coalition, as a matter of fact, and traded it out for almost nothing.
Absolutely.
Any agreement reached at a convention over party planks or whatever is meager at best because it's not something that's enforceable in terms of legislation. There's no standing to bring a lawsuit. You promised that you would seek this bill and you didn't. So what is it exactly that Sanders could be handed as consideration by Clinton if she were so inclined to grab his support?
Well, first of all, you know, with the Jesse Jackson movement, Jesse was so in control of that movement that the grassroots had very, very little to say about what he did. And all he wanted was access. And he didn't get it in 84 and 88 because the Republicans held on to the White House. He kind of got it in 92. And so on with Bill Clinton. But this is a different situation. This is a real grassroots movement, and it's growing every day. And in fact, these are people who Bernie cannot tell what to do. It seems to me that they're telling him more what to do than the opposite, which is good. I mean, that he listens, and that he's humble enough to understand that this is a movement. So I think certainly if the Clinton campaign does in California what they've done in New York and other places, the pressure upon Sanders to remain neutral and to say, in effect, that he will let his voters, the people who voted for him, to decide on their own what they choose to do. In that situation, you know, everything is wide open. Now the other thing is, Sanders could take Trump's advice and run as a third-party candidate, which would consolidate the Sanders legacy. And I am of the opinion that in a race where Sanders, let us say, would be the presidential candidate of the Green Party with Jill Stein as his vice president. I don't know how many states they're on the ballot in, but that throws this election wide open, and no one could predict what the outcome would be. Because I think Bernie would be on the Green Party ticket as an independent in the same way that it was in 1992 with Perot. Bernie would be competitive in the big states, the swing states. And, you know, we're kind of entering new territory. We have never been here before.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.